Alive and Kicking with Claire McKenna. This is News Talk.
You can email the show alive and kicking at newstalk.com, or you'll find me on Twitter and Instagram. I'm at Claire's Lair. Coming up, Roz Purcell and her running trainer John O'Regan on their virtual race Together Apart We Run. Former magazine editor Ellie Balfe on why lockdown became her launch time for her new online platform Heyday, aimed at women in their midlife. And the wait for a vaccine, Professor Adam Finn on why this race needs to take its time. So what kind of health and wellness week did I have? Well, one of the best things I did for my mind, body and soul this week was to beam a couple of our friends into our living room and watch them DJ in aid of inner city helping homeless. And we only have this brutal speaker thing that we hook up to the phone. So we had started that and decided it wasn't good. So we ended up trying to get the live stream on the TV. And to see my husband's best mate playing records on our TV screen in the corner of our living room after all these weeks of lockdown was an absolute joy. And because he started at 7 p.m., my kids sadly have outgrown that bedtime. So I knew they were going to be still up and about. So I wanted to get them involved. So we got a disco light going. We had it all set up in the sitting room. We danced. It was the most social that I have felt since all of this happened. Of course, it was tinged with a sad realization that it's going to be a while before there's a real dance floor that we're all on together. And when we saw our other pal arrive to take over at 9 and begin his DJ set, it was weird to watch two people that have known each other for years, not hug, not handshake. But look, there was music, there were friends in our living room, and I absolutely loved it. I have found phase one a little bit freaky this week. The air of everything's grand, but everything's not grand. This kind of cautiousness and relaxing of the restrictions. I have not felt compelled to visit a garden centre as of yet, but I have been moved to make a mask part of my shopping attire, as I mentioned last week. And Blind Boy, in one of his recent podcasts, was talking about how one of the reasons that we struggle with wearing it, if we do struggle, is because we want to conform and not stand out too much. And it's also hard to get our heads around the reverse that we're looking at in this, that we're wearing them not to protect ourselves, but to protect other people. And it's funny how he of the plastic bag wearing, who is a very intelligent and well-read lad, is the one who solidified my thoughts on it. But he wasn't claiming to be an expert, but he was quoting Professor Luke O'Neill. He's the professor of immunology at Trinity College Dublin. There's a brilliant video on News Talk's Facebook page interviewing Professor O'Neill that actually drove me to order the masks for my family in the first place. But when we're in public or out shopping or on public transport and we cover our nose and mouth, we actually reduce the chances of passing the virus on from 70% if only one person is wearing a mask and they come into contact with someone with the virus who isn't wearing a mask, to 5% if the person who is carrying the virus, and remember that's without symptoms, if they're wearing a mask and the other person doesn't, it goes down to 5%. And if both are wearing a mask, the chance of transmission is 1.5%. So I just think with those sums, I'm just going to have to don it. It's becoming a fashion accessory. I saw somebody putting up that Helen Steele is making them, and she makes incredible clothes. So I might make a fashion statement with mine, or may not. But that science is hard to argue with. And that's the latest research coming from the Mater Hospital. And Blind Boy also spoke about empathy and how looking out for other people helps us to fight against the natural anxiety and the fear, which is all around the place right now and quite normal. But that can lead us to be defensive and think only of ourselves. So I think we need to be thinking about spreading the love, not the virus, which I think is quite a good slogan. And maybe Boris could have considered that when he was changing stay at home to stay alert. And if we start wearing a face covering, it'll be normal before we know it, and we'll be on our way back to the real normal, normal. Now, I promised way back when I started presenting this show that it would never be about what you should be doing. And I want to be clear as we go into the next item that I'm not saying that you should be spending your time in restriction training for a marathon or learning a new language or cooking banana bread or any of that stuff. If you've been surviving on Cocoa Pops and Netflix and you're happy with that over the last while, I am happy for you. But Roz Purcell, it seems, does not like to sit still. And along with her sister Rachel, she's planning to run a marathon in August. She wants you to run with her virtually. And she's on the phone now with her running coach and ultra runner, John O'Regan. Well, hello to you both.
Hello.
Hello, thanks for having us.
I just want to say to anyone, I have honestly started a new addiction to Cocoa Pops as well. And I have completed Netflix. So anyone who's listening, who's like, oh God, Roz Purcell is being motivated, like, I am eating whatever. I am just getting through this period as well. Like, I've lost all my motivation. And that is why I started Together Apart We Run, which was just really, I think, before all this started, I was in New York getting set to do the New York Half Marathon. And, you know, obviously found my way home from New York in a rush. But, you know, 2 months in, I realized that I wasn't able to run a half marathon if I had to do one. I'd lost all my running fitness and I just wasn't training. I didn't have any motivation to do it. And I kind of just wanted that back. And that's obviously, I've met John. I've known John for years and he's always been a huge running inspiration. And really, it just kind of started with myself wanting to have a goal to work towards and having a plan, because I think, like a lot of us, I was just day to day, every day was running into the next. I didn't know what day it was and I really didn't have any aim with training or anything. So my sister and I just decided that we would put a date in the diary and we would just do our own half marathon and retrain for one again, because we kind of felt a bit sorry that we'd lost all the miles in our legs. And we asked John, would he do a program for us? And then it just grew, didn't it, John? It just kind of grew into this.
It was incredible, yeah. All of a sudden, it just came out of nowhere. And what you mentioned there about having the definite date, I think that at the moment, with all races and other events being cancelled, that people don't have anything to actually aim for. And if you don't have something to aim for, you're less likely to go out and do something. So I think having this definite date, that's our goal. And we know that you have to do something bit by bit to actually get you there successfully.
And what's nice about it is that it's virtual. So you don't have the big pressure of the big sign up, the lottery that comes with some of the entries to certain marathons. And on the day, you just get out on your own around your home. So you don't have to kind of get yourself into town. All that kind of stuff is taking a bit of the pressure off.
And as well, you know what? Like, even for someone like myself, who I do like and enjoy training, I find the whole idea of going to a race nerve-wracking. Like, I hate the competition element and I hate people looking at your time. So with this, none of that is there. You know, you go out and do the run for you. Doesn't matter what time you get. Doesn't matter what time anyone else got. It's just for you to have a goal and to work towards. And obviously, it's great that John put together really easy plans that anyone can follow. So there's a 5K, a 10K and a half marathon that you can work towards on August 2nd. And everyone just at the same time at 10 a.m. goes out and starts their own race.
And John, can we talk about your credentials as a running expert then? Because they're pretty impressive. You ran 7 marathons on 7 continents in 7 days. Is that how is this possible?
Well, I won't call myself an expert because, you know, I'm even learning as we go along with this process. But so I started running 20 years ago. I set myself a target of running on every continent, which I did over the course of 7 years. I completed the toughest races on each continent. And then most recently, I ran 7 marathons, 7 continents in 7 days. So that was more of a logistical than a physical challenge. But I took part in an event called the World Marathon Challenge, and I was guide runner to a visually impaired athlete, Sinead Kane. So it's like everything else, I suppose. You just have to plan it, prepare for it, and just get on and do it.
Yeah, well, running a marathon virtually on August 2nd for me would be the equivalent of 7 marathons on 7 continents in 7 days. Where are you at with running, Roz? I know you love fitness and health and you do a lot. But what do you like with running?
Well, I guess I have a love-hate relationship with it. And for someone like myself, and I would always say I'm a huge advocate for moving and climbing and running and everything like that, I've definitely lost my kind of mojo and my motivation with this whole lockdown. And that's why I need a plan and I need a goal. And look, there's days I definitely don't enjoy the program and there's days I love it. But I like having goals to work towards. And, you know, I'm not back up to my half marathon distance, obviously. But I think with John's program, I'm slowly getting there. And the great thing about the program is we've given people a lot of time. So, you know, even though We are in week two. If you want to jump on now, we've given people a lot of time to slowly build the miles in your legs, which is the safest way to do it. And I think the whole thing for the program and what we decided to do was to make it as enjoyable as possible, because, you know, during this lockdown, you don't really, like you said, you don't want to be feeling like you're forcing yourself to do something, or you don't want to be not enjoying something. So we've made the program as enjoyable as we possibly can, and, you know, slowly building it up in short runs. And obviously we're very lucky with the weather at the moment, so it's making it a little bit easier.
Well, I was checking out your Instagram page, Together Apart We Run, and a lot of the questions coming through were saying, what level of fitness or running do you need to be at now to be able to run the marathon in August? So what's your answer to that, John?
Well, we have a 5K, a 10K and a half marathon. If you're at a reasonable level of fitness, you should be able to complete the plan for the half marathon. If you feel that you have been sedentary for quite a while, then I suggest joining either the 10K or the 5K. 5K is, I think, a good all-rounder. Now, with the plan, there's no pressure for anybody to do anything, but you'll find that there is a little bit of accountability as small groups are starting to form, because we have people signing up or joining the page, and then they're tagging their friends, so their friends are coming on board. So you have someone who, the kind of knock-on effect there is, it's starting to snowball, that we have all these small groups within the group. But if you're unsure, I'd say go for the 5K. Anything is better than nothing. But if you have any kind of a reasonable level of fitness, join one of the other ones. And I'd say a big problem that you find with people when they start off an exercise like running is that their cardiovascular fitness improves quite quickly. And because they're starting to enjoy it, or they realise that they've enjoyed it, they start to maybe try and do a little bit more, and they feel that they can go further than what the programme is actually suggesting. But it takes longer for the muscles, bones, the connective tissue in the lower part of the body to catch up with your cardiovascular fitness. So it's important not to get ahead of yourself. Let your body adapt to the process and just follow the plan. And when you get beyond August 2nd, you can then use that as a stepping stone to something else.
Now, should running always feel good, John, on your body and on your head? I mean, if you're feeling exhausted after a run and your knees are aching, is that normal? Do you just need to make adjustments or build yourself up a little bit more?
Yeah, I would say if that's how you're feeling, you should take two steps back before you go to one step forward. Now, it shouldn't feel bad. And chances are, if you're sitting at home wondering, should you go out or should you not go out? If you decide on not going out, you'll probably end the day with having a bit of regret. But I haven't met anyone who has actually forced himself or made that decision to get out and then regretted that part of it, and you feel that bit better. But you shouldn't be feeling any pain in your knees, ankles, hips. And if your pain is your body's way of telling you there's something wrong, or you're doing something wrong, or maybe you're doing just a little bit too much for where your fitness is at the moment, so take a step back and try and ease back into it. That's what we started off the plan with, a lot of walking. And we encourage people to run easy. An easy pace is one where you should be able to hold a conversation. You have no problem talking. If you're struggling for your breathing, or you can't string more than one sentence together, you're going too fast. Don't compare you with somebody else. It's your fitness, not the person beside you. And a harder pace is just that little bit more of an effort. Almost as if you were late for an appointment, or you were running for a bus. You're not sprinting, but you're making that little bit more of an effort. But for the most part, you should not be in pain.
And Roz, when you were training for New York, does the graph kind of go like, running is hell, running gets better, running is good? Is that how it works when you're training for long distance running?
Well, I can only speak from my own experience, and it's definitely been... it's not a linear experience, let's just say that, where I definitely think when you start, I think that your first few runs, you're like, wow, this is great. I feel great. Wow, it feels so nice to get out in the morning. And like John says, you know, you never regret a run. You feel great after it. And then I think it's maybe in the middle where your running starts to pick up, your distance starts to pick up a little bit. That's when, you know, I might have a lull and go, oh, this is really hard again, and I'm not really enjoying this. And I think, you know, depending on the day, how tired you are, and maybe if you've got a lot of work on, you'll find maybe reasons not to do it. And, you know, even someone like myself that's definitely on a program, I'll definitely end up missing some of my runs. So it's up and down. And over the years, my experience with running has also been up and down, whether I enjoy it or not enjoy it. But I think the accomplishment that you get after doing a race or after working towards a goal, it's totally worth it.
Yeah, with any kind of goal, whether it's exercise involved or not, being able to tick that off the list is always a really good feeling. Yeah. So how much training commitment are we talking, John? How many times a week?
I think we have 3 times a week is the minimum, and one of the plans has 4 times a week. I try not to have it where you would have 2 rest days together. So you might have 2 training days together in some plans, but we try and avoid the 2 rest days. But only do what you can do. There's no real pressure. The plan itself is a suggestion. It's not a prescription. You know, you don't have to do it. And I would also say to people, if you do have problems with your knees, ankles, or you're not able to run, it's not all about running. Do something. Anything is better than nothing. And what we're really trying to do is just encourage people to go there and get moving. And with the human body, the more you do, the more you can do. It's not like a machine that breaks down with use. We need to be used, because with fitness and strength, if you don't use it, you lose it. So it is important to do something.
Good stuff. Well, remember, you can do a 5K, a 10K, or the half marathon if you fancy it on August 2nd. Go to Together Apart We Run, Together Apart We Run on Instagram. There's also a Strava Running Club link that you can get there, and I might tweet it later if you need more information. But Roz Purcell and John O'Regan, thank you very, very much.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much.
Coming up, the race to the vaccine.
Alive and kicking on News Talk.
So known as the ultimate leveller, the global pandemic has seen a global response to the virus, including a worldwide research effort to understand it better, find treatments, and ultimately a vaccine. Professor Adam Finn is a paediatrician who's spent years working in the area of vaccines, and at the University of Bristol, he has recently begun looking at the coronavirus. He's on the line now. Hello, Adam.
Hi. Hi, good morning.
It's been a crazy time for all of us, but you've also had your work life turned upside down.
Yes, me and a whole bunch of other colleagues at the university here who've essentially stopped doing what we were doing before and devoted ourselves for the last two and a half months now to working on this problem, yes.
And what has it been like? Is there an urgency felt? Or do you have to treat this as you treat any virus or any vaccine that you're looking at?
Well, the answer is both. We certainly, like everyone, feel the enormous sense of urgency. And this is really why we've repurposed ourselves to focus on this problem, because it's just jumped straight to the top of the list of things we have to deal with. But I would also emphasize that the other problems that we have to do work on have not gone away, and we can't forget about them. And also, in the rush to try and find answers to the important questions this pandemic throws up, we have to hold on to some kind of scientific rigor and do things well, and not rush them to a point where the answers we generate are not good quality answers, or we in fact would end up slowing things down rather than speeding them up.
Because looking into you for this interview, I could see that you've spent a great deal of your career looking at meningitis in children, and there's as much of a will to see an end to that as there is to a global pandemic, albeit affecting a smaller number of people.
Yes, that and, you know, a whole bunch of other infectious diseases that have either emerged recently or have come back to trouble us from the past with the gradual drift away from using vaccines effectively. So meningitis remains a problem which we've gone a long way towards solving but have not yet completely solved. But we're also worrying now about the return of whooping cough, the return of measles, and the emergence of other new infectious diseases as well. So yes, those things are all very much still in our minds, but coronavirus at the moment is completely dominating the landscape.
And when we look at things like immunology, something we're told, particularly when we look at autoimmune diseases and how they are on the rise, something we're told a lot of the time is that we're living in too clean a society. And at the moment, hand sanitizer and sanitizing everything has become paramount. Is that going to have a knock-on effect, that it's helping in one area but causing trouble in another?
Well, that's an interesting theory, but I certainly wouldn't let that concern get in anybody's way with regard to the absolutely critical importance of hygiene at the moment, because it's pretty much the only thing that we've got to use to fight this current pandemic, which is paralyzing everything. The concerns, or at least the idea that the so-called hygiene hypothesis, that the extraordinarily clean lives that we lead these days compared to the past has got some role in the other allergies and autoimmune diseases that we see, is still a theory. There's some evidence for it, but it's far from worked out. Whereas what we know without any doubt at all is that if you wash your hands, you're less likely to get coronavirus, or what, indeed any other viral infection, and less likely to infect other people. So I certainly wouldn't let that worry people when it comes to the current advice.
So what do we know? What are the latest developments in the lab when it comes to COVID-19?
Well, we're doing a number of different things here. One of the things that's very much in the news at the moment that we're working on is the immune response to the virus, because although tests are now becoming available quite widely that will tell you whether or not you've been exposed to the virus and made antibodies to it, at the moment, it's not terribly clear how long and how strong that protection that those antibodies provide will be. And so I think everyone's struggling a little bit to know what to do with the information. We can find out what proportion of the population in different places has had this infection. But in terms of advising people who've got antibodies, what they can and can't do, that's still a bit of a mystery. So we're working quite hard to understand what these antibodies tell us, and also to track the immune response forward in time as people get further away from the infection they've had, to see how well their serum, their antibodies, and actually their other immune cells protect them against getting the infection again or against infecting other people again. So that's that's perhaps at the top of our list, alongside looking in a lot more detail at the way that the virus evolves, and getting new tests that that can tell us what drugs might be effective against the virus in people who've got sick. And then, like many other groups, we're also working on a vaccine to try and see if we can come up with a tool that would prevent people from getting the infection in the first place.
And how important is the global effort and the sharing of information? I know there's a great deal of work going on here in Ireland also, and countries where their health system wasn't completely overwhelmed were able to take a step and record information and share that information and be open with other countries and share that. So what's it like to be part of a global movement like this?
I think it's a critically important question, and we really do need to work hard to avoid people sort of getting into one-upmanship, whether it's academic one-upmanship, you know, being the discoverer of something or other, or commercial one-upmanship, you know, being the one that comes up with the test or the vaccine and makes a lot of money out of it, because this is a global problem and it needs global solutions. And there's a real risk that if people don't cooperate, we don't get things done so fast. There can be reduplication of effort, we lose time. So just as locally we're all collaborating with each other, finding new connections, we're really working hard to do that both nationally and internationally by talking to colleagues who work in the same area, trying to make sure that we sort of work together in partnership rather than in competition. This is not really the time, in my view, for competing. It's time for collaborating.
Yeah, you hope the ego won't take over. But it is the golden question. How far away are we from a vaccine? And it's very difficult to answer. And do you think we, and when I say we, I mean the hand-washing public, need to stop looking to a vaccine as the end goal in all of this and stay focused on the guidelines that stop the virus spreading. Is a vaccine a silver bullet that we need to just wait for?
Yes. So with regard to developing a vaccine, I think everyone should continue to hope for and expect that one or more vaccines will be developed to help us combat this problem. I do agree that in the meantime, we've got to learn to live with the problem because the vaccine or vaccines that will come are not yet a reality. So we have got to adjust to that and work out what to do in the meantime to make life possible and for us to continue to be productive and not sort of sink into oblivion. But I think we should hope for vaccines. But I think we have to accept the uncertainty of how long it will be before they arrive. I would be very disappointed if we're here in 2 years and still have got nothing. It's a conceivable possibility, but it's unlikely. But I also think that it's quite unlikely that one or other of the very first vaccines that we're hearing about at the moment will turn out to be the best solution. We could get lucky, but it would be a surprise. So it's a long game. There will be disappointments along the way, but we're going to continue to work on this until we get vaccines, and in particular, vaccines that can be manufactured and distributed very widely around the globe. It can't be a local solution where we just have vaccine in rich countries and let everyone else continue to suffer. We've really got to find a vaccine solution that works for everybody.
Something else you also hear when it comes to vaccines is that it's going to need to be tested and retested, and we're not even far enough down the line of COVID-19 to understand enough about the virus, and it'll need to, we'll need to know more about how it behaves and reacts to a vaccine. So this is time, and there is that rush and urgency element. So when something does come to market, how can the general public trust it? What do we need to look out for so that we can get on board happily and comfortably?
Well, I think we can all be confident that although things are being done quickly, the key questions that we would always want to answer before releasing a vaccine into general use will have been answered. Specifically, the tests will have been done to make sure that people who receive the vaccine are not actually made ill by that vaccine, don't get unacceptable side effects and so on. So the safety testing, for example, in the vaccine that we're currently testing that's been developed by the University of Oxford is ongoing, and this vaccine will be given to thousands of people during the development process who will be very closely monitored for any signs of ill health, you know, both in terms of their symptoms but also blood tests and so on. So any vaccine that comes through and starts to be used will have been tested for safety and will also have been shown to be able to prevent people from getting sick. That's not to say things won't then go on to improve them, make them better. As with other vaccines, the first vaccine we use may not be the last, and we may find better modifications or better ways of using the vaccine as time goes by. But by the time there's a vaccine out there that people are being, you know, it's being offered to people, we will know that it's acceptably safe and that it has some evidence that it will be protective. People won't be in the dark about that.
Last year, you mentioned it earlier that it's other projects that are still important in your to-do list, if as it were, or your in-tray. There was a big focus on under vaccination with outbreak of measles, and there seemed to be a growing trend of not vaccinating, and that it was more in line with health and wellness if you didn't vaccinate your children, certainly. Now, I know that it's hard to know why people make that decision, and it's multifaceted and it's hard to define. But do you think, as somebody who is working in the area of vaccines and always very proactive in communicating to people about them, that if we have a success of a coronavirus vaccine, that people's opinions about vaccines in general will change, or will we always have the anti-vax movement?
It may well change. I think the danger of a widespread infectious disease like this is a bit of a revelation to a lot of people, because the diseases of the past that used to trouble parents in particular, you know, have been gone for more than one, possibly two generations now. People are not really aware of the devastation that polio used to cause in children, diphtheria, whooping cough, measles, and so on. Despite the recent outbreaks, the numbers affected are much, much smaller than they were in the pre-vaccine era. So I think the reality of what infectious diseases can do, is something of a wake-up call for a lot of people who've been used to living in a world more or less free of these widespread problems. On the other hand, I think we are witnessing a real problem with disinformation these days, and people are in some ways finding it quite difficult to know what to believe in terms of what they're reading. So particularly some of the stories that are circulating on social media and so on, which we've witnessed in other areas of politics quite well away from vaccines, also apply to vaccines. And that's likely to mean that there will at least be some people who are led astray by these kind of stories. But I think I would emphasize that in the end, in countries like Ireland and the United Kingdom, vaccines enjoy massive public support, the kind of support that politicians can only dream of. People in the 90% range have their children immunized without hesitation, routinely all the time. So although one hears about anti-vaccine stories and so on, they really are only affecting a small minority of people. And on the whole, vaccines are things that most people embrace enthusiastically and accept fully as being an important part of keeping their families and their children healthy. So it's important not to over-exaggerate this problem, but I think we have to accept that it does exist.
Yeah, it's just not as sexy in a headline, I suppose, to talk about the norm, is it? The negative is always the slant. Adam, you're very busy, so I'll let you get back to your work and really appreciate you coming on. I mean, every day is history in the making, and we all feel like we're very much part of history in the making. You're at the front line there, so thank you very, very much.
Always a pleasure to talk to you, Claire, and thanks for your time today as well.
And if you want to get some information you can trust, you can check out Adam on Twitter. He's at Adam H. Finn.
Coming up, why your midlife is your heyday.
Alive and kicking with Claire McKenna. This is News Talk.
So former magazine editor Ellie Balfe is used to adapting to change. Before the arrival of lockdown, the world of media was changing, with many gorgeous glossies disappearing from our shelves. So Ellie chose the time of life slowed down to launch a new passion project, The Heyday, an online platform for women in their midlife. And she's on the line now. Hello, Ellie.
Hi, Claire. How are you?
I'm very good. So did you have more time at home in recent weeks to look at this, or less time, or did you just have to block out all thoughts of recession and depression, or how has it been for you?
Well, I certainly did block out all thoughts of recession. I had tried to stay in a bit more uplifted state of mind. But yeah, I mean, I think like everyone, I had a bit of time to myself and lots of time not, what with the kids and the whole machine. But I think this is something that has been on my mind for quite a while. And I think working in media for as long as I have, I didn't see something that spoke specifically to women in their midlife. And I just didn't see my experience and the experience of my friends replicated honestly anywhere. So I really wanted to create it. So I kind of sat down, sketched it out, and it's almost ready to go.
Because I think, and I mentioned the thought of recession, not as something to bring us all down, but because we often say, I can't do this because, or you could be put off doing this and say, well, you know, now is not the time. And that, you know, and that's something that we can attribute to our midlife or to our age, that we can't do certain things because we're at a certain time. And I don't actually think that's true.
Oh, yeah, I totally agree. I think, it does take a bit of bravery. Creative bravery is something that I really subscribe to, that notion. And I think that this is the time, if any time in your life, that you have to do all the things that you've always thought of doing, or you have to at least try.
So what is midlife officially?
As in the ages?
Yeah.
I mean, for me, I'm looking at it. First of all, I think it's a state of mind. I mean, midlife is more of an attitude. I think the age between 40 to 55 might be what they deem the official ages. But I think for me, from the age of 35 to up to 55 and beyond is really the middle stages. I mean, I'm turning 45 in 2 weeks' time, and I reckon I'm probably smack bang in the middle. So I think this is the stage. This is the stage as well where you get to be more thoughtful about your life. And I think that's what's so brilliant about it.
Because it doesn't mean that anything is set in stone, but you are fairly set up in terms of a lot of life's boxes as such.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about it, you spend your 20s, you're learning, you're training, you're trying to figure out who you are. In your 30s, you might be having kids, you might be getting married, buying houses, you might be getting divorced, you might be doing all of those kinds of things. And in your 40s, you're just a little bit more established in who you are in your own self, I think. And big things are still happening to you. You know, you might be raising kids, you might have teenagers, you might have sick parents. There's so much going on. And particularly, obviously, now at this time of life, everyone's kind of thinking about their careers and what's the future going to be like. So it's a time of big thoughtfulness. And that's what I wanted to see. That's what I wanted to discuss.
Because I've been watching, like everyone else, normal people, and I've seen a lot of the discussion online. People are sort of shouting at the TV and looking for them to communicate better or make different decisions, the two main characters. But that's what happens in your 20s. You just don't have it all worked out at that point to know who you are and what you want. And that's something that I really identified with, looking at them at that age in school and in college. And it's very different, I think, in your midlife.
Oh, it really is. I mean, you know the way they say in youth, you learn, in age, you understand. I really believe in that. I mean, in your 20s, you're just kind of barreling along, racking up experiences, but I don't know if you're fully grounding in them and really knowing what they're all about.
And I always think when I hear Heyday of the Mick Christopher song, yeah, and even doing my research for last night and my questions, I was singing it then for the rest of the night. But it's the line, this is our heyday, baby, and we're not going to be afraid to shout. And that seems to be something because, you know, speaking from personal experience, when I was younger in my 20s, I used to be more concerned about what people would think of me. And as you get older, you don't care about that so much. If people aren't into what you're saying, well, then that's fine, you know. And I mean, that's with acceptance of and empathy and compassion, of course. But you're not afraid to shout and you're not afraid to say who you are and stand up for what you believe in and do what you want to do and makes you happy and you.
Absolutely. And I mean, firstly, that song, the Heyday song, is, I mean, it's the core of this project and it's my favorite song of all time. I just love it. But it's that idea that we're not going to be afraid to shout. I think that certainly when you turn 40, there's like a mental metamorphosis. Your attitude shifts. You really don't care what people think, or you care less. And it's just like this emotional liberty that I think is amazing. And I see it in all my friends. And sometimes it can be hard to get to, but you get there eventually. And it's just amazing. It's so freeing.
And do you think we're still an ageist society, or is that changing?
I think we're slowly getting there. I think, obviously, in terms of beauty and the anti-aging kind of narrative, I think we're still pushing against a bit of ageism, but I think we're certainly getting there. And I think the more voices that we collect and the more of women's experiences and this attitude, this sort of brilliant, vibrant attitude, the more we get of that out there, the more it will shift.
And do you think it's worse for women? Is that why you directed it to women only rather than anyone in their midlife?
I think it's directed at women in their midlife purely because that's all I can really speak to myself. And I think that, I mean, no doubt that midlife for men is a time of transformation as well. I've actually had some really interesting conversations with people about that. But for women, it's almost black and white. You shift into this decade and it just feels different.
I'm working in the magazine industry over the years. I mean, you mentioned it there, the beauty industry that you were very much a part of. Did you feel a part of something that was pushing youthfulness, whether it was magic cream promotion in the adverts or the young models like beginning working at 14 and airbrushing and all that side of things? Did you feel a jarring with that at the time or was that the norm as such?
I felt that it, I mean, I was very accustomed to it. So before I worked in magazines, I was actually a professional makeup artist. So I used to work on shoots and I was very much part of that, the creation of somebody looking their absolute best. But then quite frequently they would look great, but they wouldn't look like themselves. So there's an alteration that would happen in that process. And I didn't feel so comfortable with that over time. And then when I was certainly working in magazines and I was a beauty editor at one time, and the whole entire narrative is about looking younger, having clearer skin, all of these things, which are a wonderful thing if that's what you want to do. And it is, you know, when you look great, you feel great. That is an absolute truth of life. But personally, having tried, I mean, over the years, I have had Botox, I've had fillers, I've tried all of those things when I was in that space. And once I did it, personally, I didn't actually feel like me. And I look back on photos of it now and I kind of think, God, I think actually I looked older, weirdly, when I had all this Botox. But I totally think that's a personal choice and you do whatever makes you feel good.
So let's talk about your site then. What will it feature?
Well, it's going to feature a panel of female writers and myself. So I will be writing a lot. And I've got a panel of about 12 other writers who are all in their midlife. And they're going to be writing about women's experiences at this stage of life across absolutely everything. So we're going to be talking about fashion and beauty, but in a very thoughtful, slow, mindful way. It's not going to be about all of the latest trends and the new releases. It's going to be more about something just a little bit more thoughtful. We're also just going to be talking about the big topics, the conversations that women of this age are having with each other. And we're going to be quite fearless. What I really wanted to be is a brave platform for female voices. So we're talking about big things. We're talking about, you know, marriage breakdowns. We're talking about people being sick, people dying. These are all the kind of sad stories, but within them comes the real experience of life. And then we're just also talking about the joy and the vibrancy and this beautiful attitude that we see around us.
You're also going to look at well-being. So what do you think is important for that in midlife?
We're going to take on well-being quite robustly, actually. So we're going to be talking about psychology. We're talking about philosophy. We're going to even get into spirituality and all those different areas, because I think that's where the big questions lie. And I think well-being, whilst it is also your health, it's nutrition, it's fitness, it's all of those things that we know about. We're going to talk about those, but it's also understanding life a little bit more. I think there's a mental well-being that's really important to discuss and to talk about and to try and evolve in your midlife. One of my writers is a really dear friend of mine, and she lives in LA. She's a yoga teacher in LA, and she's quite high up in the yoga community out there. And she's also a philosopher, and she's writing these incredible pieces about yoga, about the transformation of that yoga can bring into your life, and how its place in a modern life. And it's just really interesting.
What about working life then? That's also a feature, and you talk about things like, or you plan to talk about things like lean back leadership, mentorship are mentioned. What do you think is important when it comes to our work and career at this time?
Well, I think there's so much to talk about. And I think particularly the pandemic has brought up so many questions around work, and everybody is working at home. And this is possibly something that suits people a lot better. I do believe that the world of work had to change anyway. So in a way that this what's happening now might be forcing that a little bit, and that could potentially be a good thing. But lean back leadership, I think women of this age have so much experience in the workplace. Many of them are at a higher level, or they might have had a corporate career and they've broken out to do something more creative on a freelance basis. There's very interesting personal stories around it, but they have a huge amount to give and a huge amount to talk about in terms of lessons, in terms of leadership. And there's a mentoring that can take place. So one of the goals of Heyday is that we can almost connect, link experience with people who might be a little bit younger or who can learn from each other. So it'll be a hub sharing this work experience in a way.
Well, I'm really looking forward to it. When does it officially go live?
Saturday the 30th.
Okay, lovely. Well, look, good luck with it. And I suppose I've one more question I have written down here. What do you think about Jennifer Lopez? Is she good for midlifers, or is she making it worse for us all to aspire to?
Oh, wow.
She seems to be winning on all levels of life, career, relationship, skin, and yet she doesn't look as mask-like as other people in their 50s.
Yeah, she looks fantastic. She has a huge amount of resources to help her look that way, right?
Yes.
And also, I mean, do we really know what's going on in her life? So I'm not sure. It looks lovely on the outside, but I'd love to prize inside a little bit more.
Well, look, as I say, I'm looking forward to reading about real women, real life stories in their midlife. It's called The Heyday. You can find it at theheyday.ie, also on Instagram and Facebook. Ellie Balf, thank you very, very much.
Thank you so much, Claire.
So that's it for this week. My thanks to my producer, John Fardy. Leisha McKenna was on research and Jojo Cordoza was on sound. And thank you to you for listening. I'll see you next week.